Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Today, some local context to international news. We brush up on the history of tariffs in Hawaii. We'll hear from a historian who connects the dots between import taxes and the overthrow of the monarchy. We'll also dive into new projections on the scope and speed of sea level rise on Oahu. Why scientists think beaches you know and love may be changing before the end of this decade. And we'll have a preview of a very special project, the latest from the Center for Oral History, the experiences of Native Hawaiian boarders at Lahaina Luna High School. And pineapple wars on Kauai? We'll explain. It's Tuesday, April 15th. Welcome back to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. Boeing is feeling the heat from the escalating U.S.-China trade war. The company's stock closed down nearly 4% today after China ordered its airlines to halt deliveries, another fallout from President Donald Trump's latest tariff announcement. Long before Trump began using tariffs as a bargaining strategy, the Kingdom of Hawaii wrestled with the question of how to use tariffs. In fact, tariffs played a central role in the overthrow of the monarchy. Historian and author Ronald Williams Jr. spoke with The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about the long history of tariffs in Hawaii, which he says charted the path to annexation.
Tariffs started actually before the creation of the formal kingdom. You know, the kingdom is started in 1840. We moved from an absolute monarchy, kind of a divine monarchy, into a constitutional monarchy. That time before, one of my professors coined the term oivivale, the native-only period. He didn't like to focus on Captain Cook and call it pre-Cook and post-Cook, so he calls it the oivivale, the native-only period. And in that period, we had a system of taxes. There were ahupua'a, that term's familiar to many people. Well, that literally was an ahu, that was an altar, where the po'a, the pig, was given. And that was symbolic of taxes that were given to the mo'i, or the king, as he circled the island every year. There was a spiritual side of this also, though. It wasn't just economic. This was the people giving taxes and giving their best fish and giving their best pig and so forth to their ali'i so that their ali'i could bargain for them with the gods, right? It wasn't this kind of European style of, you know, government and taxes and so forth. It was, we want to give our guy stuff so he's powerful enough to go get good crops for us and good rain and so forth from the gods.
Really tapping in that divine element.
Right, yeah. It definitely was a tax. You had to pay it. but it was also this means of kind of reaching out and getting stuff for yourself. So then we move into the kingdom period, the 1840 kingdom period. And really quickly, in 1843, actually, France and England signed the Declaration of Recognition of Hawaii as an independent and sovereign nation, the first brown nation in the world to achieve that recognition. And that really opens up Hawaii to trade. Now, geographically, it's right in the center of the Pacific, incredibly important spot between America and Asia. And we start to see the economy of Hawaii, right, because they're accepting tariffs and so forth on goods that are coming in. So we start to see the economy of Hawaii really just take off. And it was an article I did a while back on kingdom coins. I found a broadside in the Hawaii State Archives that was listing the currencies that were accepted as legal currency in Hawaii. And this was 1848, and there were 151 currencies.
Whoa.
I mean, I didn't know there were 151 currencies in the world, but,
yeah.
But all of that type of economic activity is going on through Hawaii. So they kind of have to make a decision. You know, do we tax the people to gain revenue, or do we tariff goods that are coming into the kingdom? And they really side on that side of tariffs, trying to keep taxes relatively low for the people. And that's what pays for the roads and the hospitals and all that type of thing. So we start to see that as the tariff as kind of a way to support the economy of the Kingdom of Hawaii without taxing the people too heavily.
And as I understand it, when we get to the 1860s or thereabouts, we start to have a debate about tariffs versus taxes, right? Some tension there.
Right. And it's, yes. And there's a woman on Ni'ihau. She sews mats, the famous Ni'ihau mats. And she sews a mat, and into the mat, she sews a protest of the taxes that she's taxed. So we see these, you know, tax protests in the 1860s in Hawaii. And so that really brings to the fore this kind of conversation about, you know, do we increase tariffs even further? Do we tax our people more and so forth? And we start to see in the 1860s, that's really the inflection point for when the kingdom was lost. was the 60s. And, you know, to back up a little bit, the Hawaiian board, the missionaries that were coming from Boston, they cut off support for the local association in 1863. They said, you've done your job. You've Christianized the nation. You know, now you guys come home and turn the churches and the government over to the Hawaiian people. And many of the missionaries didn't want to. Missionary sons. Now, this it's important to make that distinction. You know, we kind of blame missionaries for a lot, but the actual missionaries were mostly, you know, gone by this point. This was the sons and the grandsons of the mission. And they have positions in society that are very powerful. You know, they've gone into business, they're running the church and so forth, and they don't necessarily want to give that up, especially since they've gone to school back east in the 1850s and 60s, at the time of Darwin and Manifest Destiny and that type of thing. So we start to bring race into the question. And they say, well, white folks should rule Hawaii. So in the 1860s, you see this group of sons of mission. It's important also to note these aren't Americans. We always say the American overthrowing the American this. These are Hawaiian Kingdom subjects born and raised in Hawaii. Many of them never been to America. Now, of course, they've got an American legacy, but it's important to note that these are, they have their allegiance. They've signed their oath of allegiance to the Hawaiian Kingdom, and they decide that they want to keep their positions. And so they push this idea of not only of tariffs on incoming goods, but they're starting to push the big idea of their main crop, which is sugar, being not tariffed when it goes into the United States as a foreign good. And so they start to push this idea of a treaty of reciprocity between the Hawaiian Kingdom and the United States, where the sugar tariff will be taken off. And at this point, they're already, several of them are already literal millionaires. You know, today's terms, you're probably talking billionaires. So these are the richest people in the country. And they're making the argument that if you allow us this move to take off the tariff on sugar going to the United States, then that riches that we make will trickle down to the people.
Yeah, so the earliest iteration of Reagan's famous trickle-down economics.
Exactly.
There.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, what did the Treaty of Reciprocity eventually lead to? We have that sort of inflection point. Where does that take the kingdom at that point?
Yeah. So the original Treaty of Reciprocity, this is also confused quite a bit. The original Treaty of Reciprocity did not offer Pearl Harbor. It was originally in that first treaty. The people rose up and said no. There were mass meetings. We call them Halawai Maka'anana in the Hawaiian language papers. There were mass meetings around the country saying, no, we do not give up territory and we don't give exclusive rights to any country. And so the people rose up and said no. Kalakaua, who had been elected in 74, kind of on the back of the American businessman, even he said no. He said, well, no, we're not going to do this. And so that idea of giving away Pearl Harbor for the removal of the tax on sugar kind of falls away. And the Treaty of Reciprocity that Kalakaua signs in Washington in 1874 takes tariffs off of certain goods from the United States and certain goods from Hawaii. So it's really just a, we won't tax your sugar and your corn and your coffee and so forth on both sides. So it does enrich those folks in Hawaii, but it doesn't yet give away Pearl Harbor. But the key is that it has an end date. Yeah. And so moving into the 1880s, we start to see this nervousness by the sugar companies. We really need that tariff taken off again, you know, to renew the treaty. And the United States says they don't want to renew the treaty. They say it's not a good treaty for us. It's unfair on our side and so forth. To renew this, we're going to have Pearl Harbor. And so the missionary sons and the American businessmen, there are some American businessmen in Hawaii, they kind of understand that they can't afford to let this die. And the Kalakaua is against it. He has kind of seen the light. You know, I like to say that Kalakaua had a Saul-like moment. Mm. I mean, he really was on the side of the American businessman. He was making money himself on sugar. And I think one day he kind of had this understanding, whoa, they're getting so powerful they don't need me anymore.
Right.
And that's when he kind of turns 180-degree, you know, into that position. But nonetheless, he's saying, no, I'm not going to sign the new treaty. So they've got to do something. So in 1887, they literally have a coup. And the sons of the mission and the local white businessmen get together. They had formed a secret group called the Hawaiian League. We have their first oath book. We have their membership book. And it's all the names you remember. It's Castles and the Cooks and the so Athertons and the Baldwins and so forth. And they sign an oath to support the white community of Honolulu against the native monarchy. They get a small militia under their control, and they literally enact a coup on July 6th, 1887, taking over the government, making the Mo'i, the king, basically a figurehead, and they renew that Treaty of Reciprocity with the United States.
All of this driven by tariffs.
Exactly. Exactly.
Kind of alarming for today's atmosphere that we're living in right now. So, and then McKinley really puts the final nail in the coffin, if you will, in the 1890s by, in fact, putting tariffs on sugar.
Right. So the McKinley Act passes, and that reenacts the sugar tariff on the sugar coming from Hawaii, and that puts a real dent. You know, we start to see a fall in the stock market that as we talk about, that happens in 1890 in Hawaii.
So it sounds to me what you're saying, when tariffs are turned into international bargaining tool, this seems like the moment that the kingdom was lost.
Right. It's, and so people, you know, it's not that tariffs are good or bad. it's how they're used. If we look at Kalakaua and the use of tariffs in that period, and not only tariffs, but international diplomacy. Nowadays, we've heard a lot lately about waste and fraud in the government and so forth, and that's our biggest problem, not tariffs. Well, in the kingdom, if you read the English language newspapers, they were saying the same thing in that period. You know, they were basically setting up what they were going to do. And when Kalakaua built the Iolani Palace, it cost $300,000, a lot of money at that time. And the English language papers almost unanimously say, what a waste. You know, he's got an ego. He's building this palace for himself and so forth. But if you dive into the Hawaiian language newspapers and you dive into the personal writings of himself and other leaders of the time, they say the palace is international architectural testimony to nationhood. The people that come to Hawaii, to visit Hawaii, the other diplomats and the world leaders and so forth, cannot but remember that Hawaii is a sovereign, independent nation because of this palace. Kalakaua takes a trip around the world. Oh, great, he's going on a vacation. No, he's going around to sign treaties, to set up consulates. In the 19th century, there were 136 different consulates, Hawaiian Kingdom consulates around the world on six continents. And these weren't just for show. These were places that protected Hawaiian Kingdom subjects. I can give you a little story. There's a group of Hawaiian whalers who get off a ship in Port Townsend near Seattle, and the captain refuses to pay them. I mean, you know, 13 brown guys in the middle of this wild territory, who cares? I'm not going to pay them. Well, they'd be out of luck if there wasn't a Hawaiian Kingdom consulate in Port Townsend, which there was.
Right.
So they go to the Hawaiian Kingdom consulate. They tell their story. The consulate contacts the Supreme Court for the Territory of Washington, and they get these gentlemen's pay. Right. So it's a literal protection of Hawaiian Kingdom subjects abroad. These are the types of things that Kalakaua is doing. He's building a foundation for a strong nation. The sugar growers and the white local businessmen are kind of pushing back and realizing that they're going to have to actually seize power from him.
People of Hawaii knew they had their kingdom. They knew the community and culture in which they lived, but it had to be projected out to the world.
Exactly. Exactly. If you look back through time, as a historian, I've been digging this issue for about 20 years in Hawaii, and the Hawaiian Kingdom was one of the most progressive modern nations on earth. I mean, it really isn't. There's a checklist I have of facts that I wish were taught in the schools that really kind of surprise most people. In 1840, when we have that constitutional monarchy created, there is a woman, Kekaulu Ohi, who's put in as a Supreme Court justice. And I ask, you know, audiences, I talk about, when was the first Supreme Court justice in the United States? Sandra Day O'Connor, 1981. 140 years prior, the kingdom had a woman Supreme Court justice. They had women governors. They had women in the House of Nobles. 1852, the Constitution for Hawaii has universal manhood suffrage. This is a decade before the U.S. Civil War, when 600,000 men are dying over whether or not to own black folks. And in Hawaii, any race on earth could come to Hawaii, become citizens, and own property and vote. So you have this building of an incredible progressive nation, and then a small oligarchy of white men decide they need to run it, and they use tariffs and other, you know, machinations to do that.
That last sentence sounded a little hauntingly familiar. So given that what you just said, you know, how do you see this history informing us now as we all try to understand how the Trump administration is using tariffs? I mean, I realize you're not an economist, but
right.
But from a historical perspective, what lessons do you see there?
Right. I'm not an economist, and I'm also not a political scientist. I always try to remind people that I don't know what to do. I can just tell you what happened in the past. But having said that, yes, I mean, as an individual, you look and see the news and you see this idea of using tariffs as a sword to get other countries to bend to our will. And that's exactly what had happened here in Hawaii. Once we put all of our desires or all of our faith in the use of tariffs, then the kingdom was lost. You know, once we see that 1890 McKinley bill come in, we see that small group of men who had enacted that first coup understand that they've got to stop messing around and they've got to make the big move, which is overthrow the queen, take over the kingdom, become annexed to the United States. Because once they become annexed to the United States, there's no longer an importation of foreign goods. They're in American territory.
Ron, really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Fascinating local historical perspective on tariffs. Historian Ronald Williams Jr. speaking with HPR's D.W. Gibson about the role tariffs have played in Hawaiian history. Williams works at the State Archives, where many of the documents he referenced can be viewed.
Bhutan is planning a new megacity to rev up its economy, but Bhutan also wants to uphold its environmental stewardship, so it's reinventing what a big city can look like.
On one hand, it's going to feel like almost ancient, and on the other hand, incredibly futuristic.
Bhutan's mindfulness city, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Organizations across the state rely on HPR underwriting to reach engaged listeners like you. Mahalo to University of Hawaii Foundation, Gen Korean Barbecue, and Japanese Cultural Center of Kona. They believe, as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our sponsors at hawaiipublicradio.org.
There's news today about a longtime Hawaii crop that's causing some tension on Kauai. It's about pineapple shortages, at least for certain sizes of the fruit. Civil Beat's Brittany Light joins us with a story. And Brittany, some are calling this a pineapple war.
Pineapple wars. That's how it was described to me by one business owner who depends on local fresh pineapple for a dried fruit business. And it's getting pretty competitive at Costco on the 2 days a week when the store stocks its pineapple. There's just so many people rushing to get as many crates as they can.
And you describe in your piece what is really sort of a beat-the-clock approach, seemingly, at this lot of competition for a finite number of pineapples.
Yeah, it can be a little bit of a scene at the Costco store in Lihue, about a half hour before the store opens on these two mornings when pineapple's in stock. People are, waiting in line, and as soon as the doors roll open, they, book it to the pineapple, and not everybody gets what they need. So it can be a little hairy, and, these aren't just residents looking for pineapple for their families. This is more, small and mid-sized business owners, chefs, caterers, smoothie shop owners, roadside fruit stand entrepreneurs, that sort of thing.
I'm sure a lot of people are kind of surprised to hear, wait, no pineapples? Running short of pineapples? What's the story behind the story on that?
Well, Dole Hawaii here, they have recently reduced their footprint. The acreage that they farm pineapple on has shrunk in the last few years, and that's because they have phased out their export business. They used to ship quite a bit of pineapple to mainland grocers, and they no longer do that because Central American pineapple, they just can't compete with it, with the cheaper labor down there. So they're now just growing to meet local demand. And while the company insists there's no pineapple shortage, they have enough of the fruit. Pineapple comes in all sizes, and a lot of these big box stores want big pineapple. So it varies week to week, but some weeks there's not enough of that big fruit. And a place like Costco in Lihue, they're only taking the big ones.
And some of those small businesses that you spoke with and talked about in your piece really center on pineapple as the focal point of their business.
Yeah, I spoke with, the owner of the pineapple store. What do they sell? Pineapple. They specialize in shipping whole pineapple to the mainland. And then, of course, they have pineapple-themed, dish towels, earrings, magnets, all of that. But what they really do, what customers come in there for is pineapple, and that's about it. So on a few occasions in the last year, they've actually run out. They've had to refund customers, and that's something new for them. That's not something they've had to deal with before.
And the idea that a lot of visitors in particular want to ship pineapples back to, in many cases, continental United States, and yet there's not enough of a business in that area to make that profitable for Dole.
Yeah, it's the economics of growing pineapple. It's just a really intensive industry. It's also so iconic for Hawaii. As someone in my story said, you know, saying that we don't have enough pineapple, it's like saying we don't have drinking water for the week. It's something we really need here. It supports, you know, the tourism industry, but also local families, and not having it has made people pretty testy and really competitive. People are investing a lot of time trying to track down pineapple on weeks when it is in short supply over on Kauai.
And yet the folks at Dole say that there's not shortages, it's just certain size.
Yeah, small fruit, people don't want it. Even too large pineapple, it's just too big. People, you know, don't want it. Some grocers are happy to stock that, but again, these big box stores, they, you know, want it uniform. They want a crate with 5 or 6 pineapple in it, and they, you know, they don't want a big distribution of size. So that's really the issue.
That's a great, great story. Fascinating tale of pineapples on Kauai. Thanks, Brittany. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Been hearing from Brittany Light, General Assignment Reporter for Honolulu Civil Beat. You can read her story at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we jump into the world of puppetry. Maybe you're of the generation who grew up watching Sherry Lewis and her sock puppet Lamb Chop on TV. Or maybe you're Team Sesame Street, whose various-sized Muppets have captured the hearts and imagination of children for generations. Produced by the Children's Television Workshop in 1969, the educational series set on a small city street was a mix of live-action, animation, and puppetry. In the 1980s, Carol Spinney, Big Bird's Muppeteer, came to the islands to help with a puppetry workshop at the University of Hawaii. It was here that Spinney and puppetry legend Kermit Love taught and mentored a young talent from Kalani High School. Inspired by the summer program, Pam Asario jumped on a plane and headed to New York to audition for the show. She made the cut and has been animating characters like Snuffleupagus, Telemonster, and Grungetta for more than 4 decades. She even introduced a character with ties to Hawaii. For today's quiz, can you name the Muppet she created? Here's a hint. The character refers to her feathered relatives as Manu Nui. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right wins a reusable HBR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NāreitHawaii.com.
Boys are perceived to be harder to control than girls. It's that perception, not their actual behavior, that may be holding boys back the most at school.
If you are seen as a troublemaker by your teacher, that impacts the way that you start to see yourself, and that starts to shape the way that you then behave in future years.
It's part 2 of our special series, Falling Behind, The Miseducation of America's Boys. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
¶¶ level rise here in Hawaii is progressing at a faster pace than previously thought, and a new set of scientific models are showing some surprising projections about the state of our beaches and shorelines. The research comes from the lab of University of Hawaii at Manoa. Professor Chip Fletcher has been publishing models of sea level rise and beach loss since 1997. Rochelle Moscovich is a scientific researcher in Fletcher's lab. She spoke with Conversation's Maddie Bender about her team's new research.
What do you think was the first time that you noticed sea level rise in your community?
Honestly, I think it's the most noticeable on the North Shore. I would say, like, growing up in Kapolei, we didn't go to the North Shore that often because it's so far away. But when we did, we would often hang out in, like, Haleiwa and stuff. And you can kind of see some of the beach change there. And I think I really, really noticed when I started working for Chip.
Chip Fletcher, University of Hawaii at Manoa professor.
And we have a lot of, like, drone and aerial imagery of different areas around Oahu. And you can just see from imagery between a decade or two how much, like, the shoreline has changed between them.
And so tell us about how this particular study came about.
I would say that the study of shoreline change kind of started back in the early 2000s. Chip had, you know, other grad students that have moved on and done other great things. And they started to look at old USGS surveys as well as aerial imagery. And they used those images to kind of create a linear trend of how the shoreline is changing in the very long term. And then we created a different model in 2018 that looked at both the linear trend and how sea level rise directly accelerates that trend. And then in order to update that modeling, we created this new model. And this one, it includes the linear trend, the sea level rise, and then also, like, how waves directly affect the shoreline in the short term. And that's kind of, like, the biggest addition to the modeling that we've had from this study. Pretty much what we see is that the projections are, I hesitate to say worse, but, like, are more extreme than previously thought. The statistic that comes out of this study is that 81% of Oahu's sandy beach coastline could experience erosion, like, significant erosion by 2100. And, like, 40% of this loss is going to happen within the next decade. And so we usually think of coastal erosion as this long-term thing that's happening as sea level rise slowly increases. But the study kind of shows that in the short term, we're also going to see these effects.
To me, at least, one of the most impactful things this study does is look at six beaches around the island and superimpose the satellite data with these lines showing what 1 foot, 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet of sea level rise would actually mean in terms of the coast. So describe some of the things that we're seeing in that figure.
Yeah, so figure six from the publication shows three different regions around Oahu. As you said, superimposed Google Earth satellite imagery with lines that represent where the projected vegetation line will be at different increments of sea level. And so you can see the black line, which is matching the vegetation line of the current day, and then increasingly landward lines in purple, pink, orange, and yellow that show where the vegetation line may be in the future as sea level rises. And so for most areas around Oahu, including these six, as well as other places that we've modeled, you can see that the line is significantly landward of what it is now and may be affecting roads and housing. And in areas where there's, like, seawalls or hardened structures, this basically means that the beach, the sandy beaches that you see here, would be lost because the beach would not have an opportunity to move landward backwards naturally like it would. So these are just six examples from our study, but we have a web map that shows the erosion lines for basically the whole island.
It makes me think, though, I mean, looking at these maps, particularly looking at Haleiwa and Ka'ahava, as the vegetation line moves backwards, you're going over houses. And it just makes me think, if you live in these homes or if you travel along some of these roads to work, what can you do or what can be done to prevent them from sinking into the ocean?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty controversial topic nowadays on what the most appropriate timing and response is to coastal erosion in particular, because it does directly affect a lot of residences. One proposed solution is to figure out a way to like equitably create managed retreat. So that's, you know, moving the people who live in these houses to areas that are outside of the erosion zone and compensating them in some way that would allow them to still, you know, live a good life in a different area. I think the thing I would recommend is just like to recognize that it's happening. I think a lot of people kind of are almost like denying it because it's kind of like a scary and direct thing that's happening.
How do you go about having conversations in your own life or talking to people who feel that way or kind of in denial that this is happening along Oahu's shorelines?
I think it's important to just to listen. People have a lot of feelings about this, and in my opinion, change is kind of inevitable, and so we need to hear everyone's opinions. And what I like about this study is that it presents the information in a clear way that would kind of allow people to assess the future like holistically throughout the whole island.
And what do you wish listeners knew about this research, or what do you hope that they do with this information?
Okay, maybe this is a cop-out answer, but hopefully people will, again, just like stay informed about the climate risks that are happening and to also call your representatives so that they generally consider the impacts of sea level rise and make decisions that take these things into account so that we can adapt in a way that makes sense.
That was researcher Rochelle Moskachev talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Her new study was published in the journal Scientific Reports. We'll post links where you can see some of the sea level rise maps in your own neighborhood. Head to HawaiiPublicRadio.org after the show.
On the next Fresh Air, Melinda French Gates joins us to talk about her new book, The Next Day, which reflects on motherhood, grief, philanthropy, and life after divorce. Gates is the former co-chair of the Gates Foundation and founder of Pivotal Ventures, which is focused on advancing women and families. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
This Sunday, Hawaii Public Radio brings you a performance from our Live from the Atherton Mele Hawaii series. Enjoy music from Ke Aroho. Join us for Live from the Atherton with Ke Aroho Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR 1, sponsored by HMSA.
And now it's time for the answer to the backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about Pam Arciero, the Ina Haina native who's been a Muppeteer on Sesame Street for more than four decades. She was part of the last generation of apprentices to train under puppet legend Jim Henson himself. Recognized as the voice and animator of Grungetta, who is Oscar the Grouch's girlfriend, Arciero has also brought aspects of Hawaiian culture and language to the show. In 2006, she helped introduce a Hawaiian character. We ask you to name this character, who refers to her nephew as Manu Nui. For today's answer, here's a 2019 long story short interview between Arciero and fellow Kalani High School alumna Leslie Wilcox.
So I played Auntie Nani, Big Bird's auntie who took care of him as a baby bird. That was very exciting. I was able to push that Hawaiian influence in.
Auntie Nani, the answer to today's quiz. We did not have a winner on this one. If you have an idea for a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. Lahaina Luna High School is the country's oldest high school west of the Mississippi. It opened as a missionary school in 1836, and among its storied achievements is its boarding program that continues today as the only one of its kind in the state. The Center for Oral History at the University of Hawaii at Manoa has collected stories from 19 Native Hawaiian students who took part in that program. And this week, they're making those stories available to the public. We've got a sneak preview for you today. Tai Kaviki Tangan is a professor at the UH College of Social Sciences. He and graduate research assistant Wailana Madera spoke with us about the Oral History Project. For Tai, there's a personal tie-in, not with Lahaina Luna, but with another well-known boarding school program in Hawaii.
I also have an experience of being a boarder, not at Lahaina Luna, but at Kamehameha, so knowing that there's a really important formative experience that happens when you're living on campus and a deeper set of connections with the folks who are in the boarding program. I knew that this was an important story to record. And again, because of the very deep history of Lahaina Luna and its continued importance today, it was really an honor to be able to provide this service that, you know, came out of the community's request to have these stories recorded. 2022 is when the project started. We started trying to identify who were the boarders that were still alive that we could work with, and also in general where to kind of draw a somewhat arbitrary line to finish, you know, with a timeline. And it came about 1999, which that was when Pioneer Mill closed. Pioneer Mill's water system was also being used on the campus. And so it had an important impact on the farm, the agricultural operations there, which were really a core part of the boarders' experiences, where their tuition was free because they worked on the farm or in the garden or in different parts of the campus. So to capture that particular kind of boarding experience, that 99 ended up being the cutoff date. And the earliest alum that we ended up being able to contact was a graduate of the class of 1955. So wow. That's sort of how the timeline developed.
Back to working on the farm for a moment, and in particular, a pig named Julio. That was Kali'i Alapai's pig, and his story, along with his teacher, Mr. Hiromata, and Kali'i's whole crew. Here's how he tells the story of his crew taking care of the pigs, including Julio.
Our crew, because we did so good in taking care of the pigs, if it was your shift and the pig was pregnant and the thing had to give birth, you had to be there too, you know. So he's going to tell you, Mr. Hiromata's going to tell you, hey, tonight, your shift gotta go watch the pigs, and we gotta go. So, anyway, we did such a good job, our crew, and Mr. Irmata was. I had this little pig I called Julio.
Julio.
Julio. from Piglet, it's funny, of all these piglets that came out, this one little guy came to me and used to follow me all over. So one day, Mr. Iramata comes down to the pig pen, and we start cleaning the pen, and he see Julio out on the grass running around like this. So he came running inside. He's, "Alibi, the pig's loose." I go, "No, Mr. Iramata, no, it's our pet. It's our pet." And he look at me like, "What? Yeah, that's our pet. I let him out every time he comes. So, you know, he's just playing around. Time for going back in the pen. You watch. Come, I show you." I walk inside. I call a pig. The pig come to me. I open up the gate. He go right inside. I told you. But, you know, as I said, you know, we get that. We get that inside us, mm-hmm. You know. The animals can feel all this kind of stuff, you know. And so that last year doing that, I had the best time, man. In that department, it was so fun, good fun. We had to go pick up the slop on the jeep, you know, especially after school. After school, you work 2 hours. 4 o'clock we pull. So it was good fun, you know. These old red jeeps, and we used to go to the cafeteria, go get the slop with the crew, you know. We got all these young boys sitting in the back, and I used to tell them, I said, "Hey, lucky, eh? We get this job. But look, everybody, what they got to go through. Look, they say, in the core bushes, they got to go cut core." I said, "That's why we no go do bad." You know, I used to tell him, no get overtime. Listen. Because I was senior already. I went to see all that already. And so time for when I graduate, man, all of younger boys, man, it was just like, thank you. You know, we came family. You know, we were family for a. That's one thing about that school, you know. Everybody is close, especially the boarding department. The boarding department grew the food, raised the pigs, raised the chickens to support the school.
Supporting the school with good fun, hard work, and extra hours of work cutting in the koa bushes if you broke the rules. We're continuing with oral histories and the stories of Native Hawaiian boarders at Lahaina Luna High School. Back with more in a minute. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 1. We're back with oral histories from Native Hawaiian boarders at Lahaina Luna High School. It's a project that the Center for Oral History at UH Manoa has been working on for several years, and they're planning to share their work with the public later this week. This morning, we're giving you a sneak preview. Wailana Medeiros is the graduate assistant who helped put this project together. One of her key contributions was building a digital story map, which she explained to us.
So it kind of is set up in a way where it orients you to place at first, where it talks about Lahaina Luna, the boarding history, and then it goes into where each narrator is from. We're able to interview around 20-ish narrators from across the Paiaina, so from Hawaii Island, Maui, Molokai, Oahu, even Kauai, because, of course, borders, they came from everywhere except Lahaina. Right. So in the next part of the story map, we have the island chain, and you can see where each border currently lives and where we got to interview them. And some live in the place that they've always lived, and some have moved around. But, yeah, super awesome. So that kind of orients you to where they are, and you can see really the range of people that we interviewed across the 2 years that we did this project. And then it kind of goes into everyday border life. And my favorite part is the clips in and throughout the story map, where each person is really telling their story, and you can see each person talking about what they experienced. And that way you can really experience their emotions and see them reminiscing on that time that was so integral to them and their upbringing, and then eventually their entire life. And it's super awesome to see how much they can recall to a T. And that's how you know that it was so integral to their experience, because they have such vivid memories of that particular, only 4 years, really, some of them less than 4 years. bordered life, and then their extracurriculars, of course. A lot of them played sports, and their reasoning for playing sports is, oh, I could get out of work 30 minutes earlier.
Sure. Got to go to practice, coach.
And honestly, a lot of the, from what I recall, the sports programs themselves were comprised of a lot of boarders. So a lot of boarders themselves played sports and were really good. As we were flipping through the yearbooks since we went to the Lahaina mm-hmm. archives, you see all-star after all-star after all-star, and next to all-star it says boarder. So that's super awesome. So they were hard workers on and off the field, you know.
And it wasn't just sports. Love of history permeated many. The most famous alumnus of Lahaina Luna High School was David Malo, a figure of history and one of Hawaii's best-known historians. Border Brent Nakihe talked about the influence of Malo and Hawaiian culture.
You know, I never really understand who David Malo was until I'm in power, when I graduate, mm-hmm. and then I kind of looked back and started studying. Yeah, he knew that the Hawaiian people was literate, and he knew when school would be the first step. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, that was the first Hawaiian newspaper was printed there. Mm-hmm. You know, the Hale Pa'i. Mm-hmm. They get the printing station on the campus. Mm-hmm. It is the oldest school west of the Rockies. Mm-hmm. You know, just David Malo himself, mm-hmm. you know, the story behind that. And having the boarding department that began in the 50s. Or, yeah, I think my father graduated in, he graduated. Just having the boarding department there for so many years mm-hmm. and having all these Hawaiians there, mm-hmm. I feel is makes it Hawaiian. Mm-hmm. I mean, where are you going to find a whole bunch of Hawaiians, you know, working in the farm, you know, working with the pigs, the chickens, and actually maintaining everything to sustain your room and board, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know, but I feel the name itself, Lahaina Luna, I mean, you just feel like that's on Hawaiian school mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. Oh, I feel proud. Mm-hmm. Ah, like I said, man, I'm the only school with the only Hawaiian alma mater in the whole state of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I mean, what can I say? But I feel very, very proud and honored mm-hmm. to have been an alumni of Lahaina Luna. Mm-hmm. I always go back there, and I always, when I go to Maui, I always make it a point to visit the school, mm-hmm. walk around, and they got a beautiful football field now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really honored, and, you know, sometimes my wife, she kind of get, not sick, but she kind of get tired because I always sing in the alma mater, you know what I mean? Hey, well, I'm proud, bro.
The Oral History Project about Native Hawaiian borders at Maui's Lahaina Luna High School has been a complex project, but also one with personal ties, both for UH Professor Tai Kavika-Tengen and for graduate research assistant Wailana Medeiros. At Tai's prompting, Wailana talked about some of those connections for her.
I was going to say, too, the other thing I thought was really cool is that every time we were looking at in the archives, or every time Wailana was reaching out, she found somebody she was either related to or that she knew, and all of a sudden... the world around her was Lahaina Luna through all these other connections that she didn't imagine. I don't know, Wailana, if you want to share a little bit. I thought that was really cool.
I think that's how oral histories get you, yeah? Mm. Or even just being in community with people, you find all these connections. Because Lahaina Luna really was a place that brought people together from across the Pai'aina. And then they developed their own connections, right? I previously did not think I had any connection to Lahaina myself. In fact, the only time that I'd ever been to Lahaina was for this project. But yeah, being able to go to the archives and kind of flip through the yearbooks, I got to see a bunch of my uncles who I had no idea went to Lahaina Luna, and even was able to reconnect some of my family members that we hadn't talked to in a really long time. So it was cool to, I guess, not mend those relationships, but like rekindle them in a way. Yeah, from Hana in Maui to Haena Kauai. Yeah, it was super awesome too. Because I'd go home and I'd ask my grandmother, I'd be like, do you know so-and-so? And she'd be like, oh yeah, that's my cousin. Wow, I should really talk to them on the phone. And then she'd get on the phone and talk to them. And next thing you know, we're going there to have a visit. Yeah, so it was super awesome, and I feel super honored to be a part of this project, and now I feel kuleana to Lahaina for really opening up my world as well. I feel responsible for making sure that all of these stories are taken care of, because all of these people are super special and deserve to be heard.
Because this oral history project with Borders at Lahaina Luna High School is so tied to a sense of place, it's also tied to more recent events. I asked Professor Tai Tengen about that. Talk a bit about this project in context of the fires and the post-fire period and what that has meant.
Right. So the project started before the fires, and once they broke out, we had to put it on pause. And in fact, there were some narrators that had given interviews before the fires and then afterwards just didn't feel that they could continue to be a part of it because everything was so, you know, emotional, obviously, and understandably. There are others that I don't believe anyone we interviewed passed, but there were at least one person I think lost their home. And just it was, again, this moment of now that these fires have happened and there's an effort to both rebuild but also to remember what is really important about Lahaina, these stories take on an added sense of importance and meaning to capture maybe a small sliver of this experience of being in Lahaina as a boarder. But, you know, their views are, I think, really interesting because none of them were actually from Lahaina, but they came to be a part of that community. They came to be a part of that history. And so many of those, relationships that are formed and those families that they were connected to are still very present today. And I think those are really the core of what's needed when Lahaina is looking to remember what are the important parts of its history to carry forward. It is those relationships, those families, those experiences, and really the ability to thrive in the conditions of adversity, which is also a big part of the story of the Lahaina Luna border alums.
Voices and Experiences of Native Hawaiian Borders at Lahaina Luna High School, the latest project from the Center for Oral History at UH Manoa, and it's going public this week. They'll have a virtual public launch this Thursday from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Zoom. We'll have more details later today on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. That wraps up the program for today. Tomorrow we hear about climate justice, how environmental advocates are responding to funding cuts and future uncertainty. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine Cruz will be back tomorrow for more of The Conversation.